Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest great episode of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. And, of course, a big thanks and a big welcome to rock chick extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, who's with me, sort of with me and sort of without me, with me and without me. Leslie Ann, that was a title and a Beatles song with me.
Very clever reference there, I think, Mr. Parry.
Exactly. Was that a George Harrison track? Was that an Indian one?
No, well, yeah, sort of, yeah. It was all a bit ethereal at that point, wasn't it?
It was indeed. Anyway, Leslie Ann, lovely to be talking to you again today. Obviously, we've got a pile of stuff to get through. Barbados, by the way. I've got great memories of Barbados because I've got a great story to tell you about Mick Jagger down there. But Barbados want to release themselves now, become a republic. And I've got no problem with that whatsoever. If any country, any island wants to self-determine and be their own people, smashing. I do think it's a bit sort of, a bit of a, what's the word I'm looking for? Anachronistic. I can't pronounce that word. What is it?
Anachronist.
Thank you. Thank you. Anachronist, yeah. Anachronist to still have islands dotted all over the world where the Queen is the head of state. And Barbados is a lovely island. It's got a beautiful culture. It's part of the West Indies where, of course, people, you know, like the great reggae stars come from. So I haven't really got a problem with Barbados, setting out on their own. Has Barbados ever featured in your life?
Well, yeah, it has actually. But I was going to say, don't you think they could have waited until Her Majesty pops her clogs?
Yeah.
Because why sort of carry on knocking the monarchy, the royal family? Why keep reducing and pulling back and showing that it doesn't matter to them? Why do that while she's still alive?
You know what? I think that's a brilliant point you've just made, because when the Queen dies, then surely, finally, the empire's gone, hasn't it? If you know what I mean.
Pretty much, hasn't it? I really do think we won't ever see the day when William accedes. I just don't believe it'll happen. Mm. I think it'll be long gone by then.
Well,
but I was on Barbados, I'm going to say 23 years ago, because I was pregnant with my son, Henry.
Yes.
And we'd been staying on St. Kitts, absolutely glorious little place. And we were flying home via Barbados. So we boarded the plane in St. Kitts. We get to Barbados and we have to transfer to another flight. At which point, the very officious British Airways lady at the check-in desk refuses to allow me to board the plane because I'm 20 weeks pregnant.
Sorry, a British Airways person?
Yeah.
Oh, blimey, you know.
Local BA staff, you know.
Home airline, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So have I got a doctor's certificate? So I said, well, obviously, no, I didn't need one to depart the UK. I've been on St. Kitts. Oh, no, we can't have you board the flight unless you've been examined by a doctor. Mm. They then put me in a taxi and I had to go right the way across the island to a hospital on the other side and wait to be examined.
That must have taken an hour and a half journey in the first place.
Exactly. And my husband at the time then stayed at the airport with the other children, and it was touch and go whether I'd actually make the flight home.
Right.
So all of that put me under immense stress, and I might have gone into labour there and then.
Golly. And did it resolve itself happily?
Yeah, the doctor examined me. I was completely fit and well. I wasn't likely to give birth on the plane.
No.
There was a thing, wasn't there, at that time that, if you gave birth in Harrods or something, they had to give you a sort of season ticket to Harrods. Or if you gave birth at the Arsenal football ground, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So people were a bit worried that you'd give birth in places where they might have to cough up, let's say.
Right.
But nobody wants to give birth on a plane, right?
No, well, absolutely. I should imagine you're right. So my story about Barbados, and I must say that over the last few years, some of my regular listeners will have heard this story already, but I'm going to try and outflank you now here with a rock star story, right? Because what happened was Jerry Hall, who, by the way, I want to be very polite about because she's now married to Mr. Rupert Murdoch, who is the media baron who owns some of the companies that I work for, okay? But Jerry Hall at the time was married to Mick Jagger. And what happened was you will know more about this story than me, but she'd finally fallen out with Mick because he had been revealed to have yet another affair with another woman. She then, amazingly, shacked up or, you know, had a friendship with a guy called Robert Sangster, who was a very wealthy and successful horse trainer, okay? And part of the elite, you know, in the racing world. And this all happened in this country, but everybody suddenly found out Mick was in Barbados. Now, I was working in New York at the time, so I got a call and said, you know, oh, you know, Jerry Hall's left Mick Jagger, go and find out what he thinks about it. So we had to go down to Barbados. So, you know, which, you know, it's a job, you've got to do it, isn't it? So
it's tough at the top, Mike.
Exactly. So I get down there, and as usual, because as you quite rightly say, I'm smarter than the average bear, I got there before everybody else. So believe it or not, we checked in to Sandy Lane's immediately. Sandy Lane's was the best hotel in Barbados in those days, but nothing like as magnificent as it is these days. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
These days, Sandy Lane's is one of the world's top hotels. In those days, it was just like the best hotel in the Caribbean. You see what I mean? But nevertheless, we stayed there. So, of course, I start getting going. And I had a photographer with me called Derek Hudson. And I said, we're going to find Mick Jagger. And he said, but it's impossible. You know, behind Sandy Lane's hotel is the Sandy Lane's estate. And it's just like great plantation houses, you know, like hundreds of them. And I said, no, we are going to find him. We're going to find him first. And I said, no, you know, it's no hope. Let's wait till the boys arrive. Because you know as well as I do, Leslie-Ann, that some people prefer working in packs. And Derek said, well, when the rest arrive, then we can split up the, you know, all the areas and then we'll all share it. No, we're not sharing it, Derek. We're going to go and find him, you know. So we must have been out for, it must have been 9 hours, honestly. And eventually knocked on this door and a maid answered the door. And I said, oh, hi. I said, I'm Mike from the record company in London. It's Mick here, please. She said, oh, she said, I'm sorry, sir, you've got the wrong house. I said, why? She said, this is Keith Richards' house. I said, okay, well, where's Mick? She said, oh, Mick's down the lane. She said, if you come out of the drive and go down to the bottom of the lane, you'll see that's Mick's. Oh, I said, thank you very much indeed. You know, bang. So we were driving a Mini Moke. Do you remember Mini Mokes?
Yes, I do. Yeah. God, I used to bomb around the place in those.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So so we head down the hill. Me driving, Derek standing and looking to try and find a house with his cameras flying off his neck. You know what I mean? It would have made a great dramatic picture of Fleet Street in progress. And Mick was sitting by the swimming pool in the house at the bottom of the hill, and he saw us coming down, and he got up and he went inside. So we got there, and as usual, I was, you know, the epitome of diplomatic joy and all that kind of stuff. And
diplomatic joy.
Yeah, yeah.
What is that?
Yeah. Well, I didn't go in and start kicking doors down or anything like that. You know what I mean?
Should hope not.
And what happened was that somebody came to the door and all that kind of stuff, and I explained what I wanted, and I said, look, you know, it's one picture, one talk, all that kind of stuff. And after about an hour, to my utter shock and astonishment, because I don't mix with rock stars like you do, Mick Jagger came out and he said, okay, scribe, what do you want? And sat on the wheel arch of the Mini Moke, you know. And I said, well, look, it's like this, you know. And I explained and he said, yeah, yeah. He said, yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, what do you want me to say? And I said, well, you know, all right. He said, look, you've got to do me a favour. And I said, yeah. He said, you've got to go and get an assurance from your editor that if I speak to you, you will never come back here again. And in those days, the problem was, Leslie-Ann, the only way to do that was to go back to the hotel, send a telex or a fax to London and hope that one would come back. You know what I mean?
Anyway, by which time Mick's got in his private plane, yeah, and he's off the island before you can be back there.
And flown off, yeah. Anyway, you won't believe it. We did all that, came back, and he did talk to me. And he talked to me with me sitting on the end of...
his bed?
No, the end of the swimming pool... board, you know, what's
diving board? Dime
board, sitting on the end of a diving board.
What, you were on the end or he was on the
I
end?
I was on the end. I was on.
Oh, Christ. So if you said anything wrong, yeah, over the side you go.
I could have gone in. He could have bounced up and down and gone in. But we got a picture, we got the talk, got all that kind of stuff. And it was marvellous. And that was my sort of one and only experience with Mick Jagger, but it was marvellous. And
we only need one, don't you?
Well, of course you do. No, you're absolutely right, actually. You're absolutely right about that. If you meet a superstar once, it's a much, much bigger thing for the rest of your life than meeting them several times, if you see what I mean. Now, that sounds...
Of course, because each subsequent time, you know, the shine wears off a little bit more and they become that bit more human every time you reapproach them.
Exactly. I've been on Rod Stewart's plane once, okay? Rod's a big football fan, and when I worked on TalkSport, we would talk occasionally on the radio about things and all that kind of stuff, and he once invited me to go to Glasgow with him to watch Celtic Rangers in the semi-final of the Scottish Cup. And, you know, it's the most amazing gesture, the most amazing thing I think I've ever done. You know what I mean? Can you imagine it? You know, Rod Stewart's private jet and all that kind of stuff.
It doesn't get better than this.
It doesn't get better. And I've got a picture of Rod and I standing next to the plane, you know, with the Celtic flag and all that kind of stuff. And the inside of the plane was beautiful. He brought his two youngest kids with him, two little lads then. They're a bit older now. And they were delightful, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And it was a marvellous, marvellous experience. My colleague, Alan Brazil, who is a Scottish international, and therefore Rod, you know, respects Al as much as Al respects Rod, has been on Rod's plane several times. But I'm glad I've only been on it once. I know that sounds mad, but it was just an outstanding experience, you know, which I'll never forget for the rest of my life. You must have been on a few private planes with a few rock stars.
Yeah, I went on the Bronze Learjet once. Bronze was a record label and they had their own Learjet. And Alice Cooper was in town and they were taking him on a... Yeah, they were taking him on a promotional trip around the country. So the plane would go, you know, from city to city and off we'd all get and Alice would do his thing. But they had the bloody snake on the plane. Oh, you know that film, Snakes on a Plane, which I wouldn't go near? He had this... I think it's a boa constrictor. It's a gigantic thing. And they have this snake on the plane. This is your worst nightmare, you know? So, no, thank you. I'm not going near the Bronze Learjet ever again whenever Mr. Vince Fernier, a.k.a. Alice Cooper, is on board.
Good God. Amazing. Well, those experiences, we should be very lucky to have had the careers we've had to be able to enjoy them. Now, we have spoken about a man called Hugh Grant before, and, you know, we've
told, haven't we just, yeah,
a lot of stories, but he's on the front of a few magazines at the moment because he's 60 years of age. I'll read you a headline from one particular magazine here, and this is Hugh Grant. Mr. Nice Guy's never been me, says Hugh Grant. I can vouch for that. What about you?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Mm. We know the other side of the story, right?
Yeah. I mean, we told this story before. I'll tell it briefly. I was in LA with Caroline Graham, great friend of yours and mine, the West Coast correspondent of the Mail on Sunday. And that's when the story broke, literally overnight, of Hugh Grant, for some mad reason, must have been the maddest moment of his life, suddenly hearing a tap on the window of his car, and the policeman asked him to open the door to find a woman down between his legs performing oral sex on him, it is alleged.
Oh, come on, family show, Mike.
I know.
You can dish it out, but you can't take it.
Yeah, I know, it's a family show and all that. And then...
You know how the police got him, by the way?
Go on.
Because something was going on with the pedals of the car and the lights were going on and off, on and off, rhythmically.
You mean that he was being excited by the woman he'd hired and his feet were tapping up and down on the... Like, the
brake. Allegedly, yeah.
My God. What a way to be found out, eh?
In it.
Yeah. But anyway, I was there, not kind of on holiday, but I'd gone to see Caroline and we're hanging out, so to speak, you know what I mean? And then she was dispatched to, was it San Francisco, where the lady concerned lived, had fled to or something? I think it was San Francisco.
No, this is where we come in.
Right, go on.
Because I was working for the News of the World at the time.
Right.
And Stuart White was our West Coast correspondent, brilliant journalist, and, you know, very, very well connected. Mm. And we had this ahead of everybody else. We found Divine Brown, the prostitute, via her auntie and uncle.
Right.
We paid them $100,000, got them a private jet up to the desert, up to Bel Air, put them in the most exclusive hotel under strict instructions not to talk to anybody. Yeah. We locked them in, basically. And then shipped in a copy. We had this, You know the dress, the Versace dress that Liz Hurley wore with all the safety pins down the side? So we had one run up in the East End in London. Had it flown over, a red version of the original black dress, and got her some designer shoes and all those porn shoes. You know. And in fact, I still have the photographs on my desk here because I've got to give them back to Stuart. I told the story in my memoir last year. And so we had her secreted away, and we had 13 pages in the News of the World, absolutely killed the world.
Fantastic. Well done. As usual, you cracked it. And of course, Hugh Grant has never forgiven Fleet Street ever since, has he? No. Whenever you see him at anything, like any sort of PR do, any film launch, any, you know, red carpet, he sneers and spits at the press, you know, you filth and all that. Of course, like everybody else who has become famous through us, through the media, through the press, then throw it back in your face and say you're scum and all that.
Yeah, but look, we weren't the one in the car with the prostitute, right? He was the one who did it. Exactly. And somebody attacked me a while back.
Yeah.
She said, this woman to me, you know, it's outrageous the way you follow these celebrities around. And you know, publishing their photograph when something like that happens. Ooh. I said, we did not release his mugshot to the press.
No,
it was the police who did that.
Of course it was. Of course it was. And what makes me laugh as well is that, I mean, take for instance, right, now what's the name of this guy who's on Bake Off? I don't follow that show, but he comes from Cheshire. Is his name Hollyfield or Hollyoak or something? Paul something. And
oh, Paul Hollywood, the one with the piercing blue eyes. I don't watch it. It's a really boring programme.
But I was intrigued.
He's a shagger as well, isn't he?
Oh, he's a big shagger. So he goes down to his local pub. I think it's in Kent, or maybe wrong, but it's certainly one of the home counties in Kent. And he's become a celebrity, and he suddenly spots a very, very attractive young lady behind the bar. You know, she's a bar person, not a barmaid these days, a bar person, okay? And he suddenly gets in there, and she ends up becoming his girlfriend and living with him. And I think she's about 25, and I think Paul Hollywood is about 49 or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and she wasn't the first bar person. There had been another one before that. And there'd been a TV presenter in America who he'd presented a show with, and that sort of that developed to a little bit of a hanky-panky and dough in the kitchen cupboards.
Yes, I know.
I think his dough rises rather well, from what I've heard.
His dough rises rather well. This is a family show a few minutes ago, Mr. Jones.
Here he goes.
Anyway, so the point of this story is that their romance lasts about 6 months, okay? And then she presumably wakes up one morning and thinks, God, I don't know why I'm, you know, sleeping in this bed with this fat middle-aged man, you know. But he is Paul Hollywood. I've been here for 6 months. I think it's time to, flee and, fly the nest and all that. And people will love me. And about...
Oh, not... Hang on, there's something else happened in there. He asked her to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
That's right, yeah.
And she threw all her toys out the pram at that point.
Well, I think she found that a good peg on which to write, I'm getting out. So every 3 days now, in one of the tabloid newspapers, you see a picture of Summer, because that's her name, this young girl, right? I can't remember her surname, but her first name is Summer.
Something double-barreled.
Something double-barreled, absolutely. Walking her dog down a country lane in a pair of extremely tight, you know, shorts and sort of, you know, low-cut top and all that kind of stuff. She looked, excuse me, like she's come out of a beauty salon or something like that. And you kind of think, wow, you know, isn't that amazing that somebody just caught a picture of her and all that? And, of course, what I'm trying to do is, and, you know, we mustn't sort of turn ourselves in against our own profession, but don't people realise that what she's trying to do now is to cash in on having been Paul Hollywood's girlfriend for about 6 months or something like that and become famous? And I don't blame her for trying that, but it doesn't really always work, does it?
Well, you've got to have a little bit of something to offer over and above and beyond what you're known for. You know, you can't just make a career out of having shagged Paul Hollywood. Because guess what? He's not that big a star. You need to have something to offer. You need a USP.
Yes, exactly. And has anybody that you can think of during their life actually come out of a relationship? I mean, for instance, take Peter Crouch, the footballer, 6'7" tall, OK? He's got a wife and a girlfriend. Whose name I can't quite remember.
What, he's got a wife and a girlfriend?
No, sorry, he's got a girlfriend who became his wife.
Oh, okay, got it.
So,
got to be careful with the wording, Michael.
You certainly have. You're absolutely right there. And she's now famous in her own right, really, for being quite bright and intelligent, mother of their four children, but still very fashionable and model-like and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? She sort of grew into it. She was a famous model, wasn't she? But
can't remember her name. No. She's very funny, actually. I've seen her in a couple of things.
And
she's very sharp, got that sort of Liverpudlian wit and,
absolutely.
You know, sharp tongue and so on. Yeah, she's watchable.
Absolutely. But I have to say, I do not blame these young ladies for trying to make a go of it. Because I say to anybody in life, go on, if you think you can do it, seek an opportunity, make yourself great. I mean, for instance, Jerry Halliwell, you know, who became one of the most famous women in the world when she was part of the
Spice Girls,
was actually not good at singing or dancing or anything, but she had an enormous personality, didn't she?
I wondered what you were going to say then.
No, but I mean, you know what I mean? She, the force of her personality got her into the group, didn't it?
Well, I think it was all of their personalities. You know, it was a combination. It was chemistry, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They were a manufactured pop group. They were all larger than life.
Yeah.
The idea to name them after different spices according to their looks and qualities was genius.
Yes.
And it's no different from what Simon Cowell has done in subsequent years, putting pop groups together like Little Mix.
Yeah, sure. No, I totally agree. Totally agree with you. I think we've talked about who the next James Bond's going to be in the past, but it looks now like Tom Hardy has risen to the top of the list because the bookmakers have stopped taking bets on him. Tom Hardy is, to my mind, greatest roles he ever played was in Peaky Blinders TV series. I know you don't watch a lot of TV, but Tom Hardy, famous actor. But my problem with Tom Hardy is he would be the shortest James Bond ever. Do you know the guy I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. And I know you have taken issue with him because he's only 5'9".
Yeah.
But did you know that Daniel Craig is only 5'10"?
Well,
so what's an inch got to do with it? So then I looked up all the other...
Come on, Mrs. Jones, this is a family show, you know, please.
Well, I know it is, but I looked up all the other James Bonds.
Yeah.
So you've got Roger Moore, 6'1".
Yeah.
Sean Connery, 6'2". George Lazenby, also 6'2".
Yeah.
Timothy Dalton, 6'1.5".
Ooh.
Pierce Brosnan, 6'1".
Yeah.
So, you know, there's not a lot in it. I think it's less to do with size than what you do with it, frankly.
Oh, dear me. Honestly, Miss Chance.
Started it.
No. You know, I told you this is a family show, and what happens, you know, we try to make it a family show, and all of a sudden you let me down again.
Are you giving me notice?
Not at all. Of course I wouldn't.
Let's not be sizist. I only found out just, actually, reading up about Tom Hardy. He was addicted to crack cocaine in his 20s, you know. He's lucky to be alive.
Really?
Yeah.
Golly. I know you don't watch a lot of television, but Peaky Blinders is my favourite TV series ever. And he played a guy called Alfie in that, who was part of the, you know, the gangster world. And he was so brilliant. You just can't believe it. And my problem, if he becomes James Bond, is that I will only ever remember him as Alfie in Peaky Blinders. So
he's typecast,
yeah.
Did I tell you, by the way, I went to a street in Liverpool where Brian Epstein had a house. And it was a sort of house on the wrong edge of town, let's say, where he used to take his pickups because he was having a sort of homosexual lifestyle in private back then when he wasn't able to do it openly. And he lent this house to John and Cynthia Lennon.
Right.
Or after they got married. It was the first house they had together.
Right.
And that house and that street were used in the filming of Peaky Blinders.
Golly. I know you're absolutely right there. They did film a lot of Peaky Blinders in Liverpool because Liverpool's got some fantastic... You know these streets of what people call little terraced houses, but in fact they go back so far. They're big houses, you know? When I grew up in Chester, we had streets there and... When we sort of got grown up and all that, some of my mates actually got, you know, betrothed and married at the age of 22 or 23, and they bought one of these terraced houses in one of the streets. They were so solidly built, you can't believe it, because they were Victorian, honestly. And they were built with what you call two skins of bricks, i.e. the outer wall was brick and the inner wall was brick, whereas these days the outer wall is brick, the inner wall is nothing. It's just like foam and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? Honestly... It's beautiful. And in Liverpool, they've got streets and streets and streets of them. And most of them, you won't believe it, surround both Everton and Liverpool football clubs. And that's why Everton and Liverpool have had so much trouble over the years trying to expand their grounds, because of these beautiful houses that nobody wants to knock down. OK, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining myself. I'm Mike Parry, the Porkmeister, and Ms. Leslie Ann Jones today. And Leslie Ann, I read over the last 36 hours, and I can't even remember who it was. Somebody has gone into a studio for three consecutive days at, I think it's 12 hours a day, to voice record their new book, and their voice has gone. And they've had to seek special treatment, right, seriously, to get the voice back, you know, giving it honey and all that. And I can't remember who it is. It's a big personality, big celebrity. But you and I read so much, I've forgotten who it is. But you, I think, either are in the process or have voice recorded your book, haven't you?
Well, it's interesting. The audio book of Who Killed John Lennon is out now, and it's been chosen for the front page of the Audible website. Ooh. It's up there. It is 12 hours long, it's true. And I recorded the first 10,000 words of it. So I've done the introduction, basically, which is called Echoes. And then there's an actress who's recorded the rest of it. But yeah, it seems to have gone down really well. I'm so pleased.
Well, I'm very pleased as well. Did it affect your voice?
I must be honest, towards the end, I was in this very small studio for about 5 hours. I had two very short breaks, sips of water. But of course, every single thing, if you blink, you know, it makes a noise, and you've just got to sit there really, really still and not think other than to read out the words on your screen, which you wrote in the first place. Mm. But every tiny sound is picked up by those incredibly sensitive microphones.
Yeah, sure.
And it is quite intensive. And I had a hell of a headache when I came out. I had to go around to a friend's and get drunk.
Yeah. And oh well, that makes you doesn't make you a bad person, put it that way. I can't remember now who it was and they rang up a friend who knew. Anyway, I'll find out later. I've never done an audio book, but I got a call one time when I was up north. You know, I was watching Everton or something. I stayed for the weekend, and somebody said, "Can you do a voiceover for a betting company for the forthcoming World Cup, whichever World Cup it was, you know what I mean?" And I said, "Well," I said, "I'm not sure." I said, "I've got this to do and that to do and that kind of stuff." And they said, "Oh, they want to pay you 25 grand.
Oh, I might be free then.
Yeah, seriously.
I think I can make it.
Yeah, so I'd spent the weekend on the lash, literally. I'd gone up there on Friday night, you know, had a great night. The game was on Saturday lunchtime, so that meant all day Saturday as well. And all day Sunday, and I had to get to this studio in Soho on Monday morning, you know. And do you know what? I couldn't believe it. When I got there, my voice had gone. And, you know, I thought, what am I going to do? You know, I can't turn this down. And it was a very, you know, big name betting company. So I went into the guys and I said, "Oh, hi, fellas, how are you doing?" I said, "Look," I said, "I need, you know," and I like demanded honey and all this kind of stuff. So I did it, and you know, I'm a very honest person. I said to the producer, I said, "Look, if it cracks and if it's not right, you've got to tell me." I said, I'm not doing a half-cocked job.
As if they wouldn't tell you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Anyway, we got through it, and I didn't think it was peak quality. I must admit, I really didn't. But they said, "No, that's great. Well done, mate. It's fantastic. Sounded great. You know, lots of energy and all that kind of stuff. You put, you know, the right enunciations on and the right amount of, you know, spirit in this and all that. It was brilliant. Thank you." And I thought, when it goes back to the client, i.e., you know, the betting company concerned, I'm going to get found out. Anyway, I didn't. They ran it. I got the check, and it ran through the summer on TV with my voice behind it. And I was ever so pleased. But I really thought, I didn't think they'd get there. Anyway, listen, moving on.
We're not always the best judge of our own abilities, by the way. I hark back to sitting exams at school.
Yep.
And, you know, I was always so nervous about exams and so over-prepared for everything as a consequence. Yep. And there would be occasions when I'd come out of an exam and think, "I think I did pretty good there, you know. I think I gave that my best shot." Other times when I would come crawling out and think, "Oh, God, that was the worst paper I've ever done." And I could never judge. So the ones I thought I'd failed miserably, I'd done well at. And the ones I thought I'd done well at, you know, weren't all that hot. So you can never judge your own ability.
No, I totally agree with that. I went to a very good school, the King's School, Chester. And I'd kind of given up on exams by the time we got to A-levels. You know, I'd found women and drink and, you know, football and all that. I didn't really care. And so I went into exams and got bum results on my A-levels because I didn't really do any work. But there was a brilliant guy that I was at school with, and I'll never forget him. His name was Martin Hazel. And he, amazingly, we went into the economics A-level exam, okay, and you had to answer 5 questions. And so we all came out, and then we went to the pub because we were like, you know, 17 and a half or 18 or something like that. And as we were talking, Martin Hazel suddenly realised he'd only answered 4 questions. You know, seriously.
What did he do, go racing back in?
No, because the exam was over. And he said, I thought we only had to answer 4. He said, oh, no, Martin, we had to answer 5. He said, oh, no, my life's over. Anyway, to get an A grade, you had to get over 75%. So he'd only answered 4, so he only had 80% to go for, but he still got an A grade. He was so brilliant that, you know, it didn't matter that he only answered 4 questions.
Wow.
But there you go.
You had another famous Martin at your school,
well,
I believe.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I'm going to move on to that. And that was Martin Lewis. Now, Martin Lewis is moneysupermarket.com, okay? I read an amazing piece about Martin in, a colour magazine recently. He sold Money.com supermarket for 87 million quid a few years ago after starting it for £100. You know, he just paid £100 to set up the site, sold it for 87 million. In the latest Sunday Times Rich List, he's worth 137 million because he's still executive chairman of the company. And so he's employed, but he also increases the wealth of it. You see what I mean? Yeah. But the reason we're talking about this is you're absolutely right. The school I'm talking about is the King's School, Chester. And last time I went there, and I was supposed to go there, by the way, in the last 6 months at the end of the school term and lecture the pupils about, you know, how to win in life and all that. And, of course, I didn't because of COVID and all that kind of stuff. But when I went a year previously to see them to set all that up, the Wall of Fame, you know, with all the most famous pupils, I was disappointed to see I'd been moved down from number 1 to number 2 in favour of Martin Lewis.
Relegated.
Yeah, relegated.
Oh, well, that's no good, is it?
Yeah. But nevertheless, I have to concede to the boy that he's actually done quite a bit better than me. But it was amazing reading what he had to say. You know, I mean, he's a very, very special guy. He has special principles, special interest in life. He says himself he's almost autistic in his concentration on detail, and that's why he did as well as he did, and that's why he goes on to telly on these programs and tells people exactly how much percentage they'll got on a particular mortgage and why they should not take this credit card at this deal. He can get a better percentage deal for them. I mean, he literally is a sort of walking computer, you know what I mean?
So if ever you made a bundle of money, he's the guy that you would want to have a personal consultation with about how best to deploy your money.
Without a shadow of a doubt, particularly in this day and age when, of course, interest rates now are literally down to like 0.2%, you know, you can't make money anywhere. Listen, I was quite pleased to see that Kate, of William and Kate fame, obviously, has now won a major, major concession against Tatler magazine, who I thought were absolutely wrong to try and belittle her and take her on by publishing a piece which was badly researched by, I think it's by our old friend Ms. Pasternak, wasn't it?
Anna Pasternak, the great niece of Boris Pasternak, who wrote, of course, Dr. Zhivago.
Yes. And they've had to take a lot of the stuff out, haven't they?
Yeah. And the weird thing about that story is that Tatler's editor is a guy called Richard Denon, who was at St. Andrews with Kate and Wills.
Right. So was he envious from the start then?
Well, no, they're great friends. They've all been buddies for a long, long time. He's very well placed, this guy. Right. He's the great grandson of Field Marshal Earl Haig of Bermondsey.
Yeah.
He's the son of the Anglican Archdeacon, Lyle Denon.
Yes.
And he began his career at Tatler in fact, as an assistant, then went on to the Sunday Times, the Mail on Sunday, and now he's returned to the magazine at the age of 38 as the editor. And he commissioned this piece. It was, as you rightly point out, badly researched, quite sloppy, which I'm surprised at because Anna is a good journalist. So between them, they've managed to cock this up, basically.
Completely.
So despite the fact that the editor is a good friend of Wheels and Cakes, their lawyers have gone, hang on a minute, not having this, you know. And they've fought back and they've demanded that quite a lot of the piece has been deleted from the online version. Sorry. Because obviously the magazine is out there. You can't change that.
Do you think they'll print an apology in the next edition?
Yeah, well, they always print those really small, don't they? So you can't actually see them. Sort of a little tiny thing on the bottom of page 9.
But I mean, some of it was horrible. Some of it was saying that she'd got thin and distressed and all this, when that was clearly not true. We've seen the pictures of her. They talked about broken relationships between her and the in-laws. I mean, it was a horrible piece. How could somebody who was once their friend allow that to have gone into print?
Well, it's disgraceful. Yeah, I agree. And particularly spiteful towards Kate's mother, Carol.
Exactly.
Who's a harmless woman. You know, she's done her best by her kids. Yeah. Maybe she was ambitious for her daughters.
Yes.
You know, quite a lot of mothers are like this. And maybe she did have a hand in getting Kate to change her mind about which university she went to so that she would collide with William at St. Andrews.
Yes.
Maybe that did happen, but that doesn't give them carte blanche to have a go at the poor woman.
And anyway, you know, just because, you know, her mother was ambitious for her children in life, that to me makes her a better woman, not a worse woman. The famous joke there, of course, was that Kate's mum had been an air hostess, hadn't she?
And whenever Trolley Dolly, yeah.
Whenever there was a royal do going on involving William and Kate was there, as soon as Carol walked in the room, they all turned and said to each other, "Doors to Manuel,
doors to Manuel." I know, very funny. But she strikes me, I haven't met her, but she strikes me as the kind of woman who would take that humour in very good part.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. I think she's a very attractive woman as well.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Yes, and she lost quite a bit of weight to get herself down into that beautiful powder blue suit that she wore to the wedding. And she did the Ducan diet, which was that French doctor who's now been struck off because the diet caused all kinds of nutritional issues in people.
Yeah.
And I think actually a couple of people died after doing that diet.
God, shocking. Listen, one guy I massively respect and I don't know nearly enough about him is Nile Rodgers, okay?
Brilliant. I love Nile.
Nile Rodgers, I think, he's had a birthday since you and I last spoke. I think he's about 69 or something like that. But
68,
thank you. Well done. And I have to say, I never even knew who Nile Rodgers was until a few years ago when I watched a documentary on Sky Arts and thought, what? And you know, he came onto the programme with his hair is not just like, what do you call it? Not just like Bob Marley.
Dreadlocks.
It's wrapped around his head, isn't it, so to speak?
You
know?
Yeah.
And he actually said and grinned and said, look, he said, you may not know my name, but believe me, you know my records, you know? And then they played a few. And it was astonishing. Every track they played, I thought, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. You know what I mean? What an amazing man, because when you get into his life story, he was brought up in the most appalling circumstances where both his mother and his father were kicked. I think heroin addicts, weren't they?
Well, his mother, Bev, was 13 when she gave birth to him.
Good God.
And his father cleared off. You know, he had the lowliest start in life, but he went on to found Chic with Bernard Edwards.
Yeah.
And he has written, produced and performed on albums that have sold, get this, 500 million units, 175 million singles worldwide. Mm. He's produced Diana Ross, David Bowie, NXS, Madonna, Duran Duran, Sister Sledge, Ashford and Simpson, Luther Vandross, the list goes on and on. He's a really lovely, down-to-earth, ordinary guy. Yeah. I've been to see him live many times, my kids adore him. He's just a really sweet guy.
Yeah, I think he made Sister Sledge, didn't he? I mean, his invention, you know, just saw these young girls and thought, right, let's get you together and all this kind of stuff. But the great story that I'll always remember about him is that he wasn't particularly famous when they were in New York somewhere and they met Grace Jones, okay? you know, of James Bond.
Grace Jones fame.
Yeah, Grace Jones fame. Yeah, you know, square head, I call her, you know, because she had like a square head, didn't she?
She speaks very highly of
you. I'm sure she does, yeah. And a brilliant character, you know, in everything she's done. But she was performing at Studio 54. And she said, after meeting, I don't know where they met, and she said, no, she said, you must come down and see me. Now, if Grace Jones is performing at Studio 54, what is she doing? Because she's not a singer, is she? So what was she doing? A bit of DJing or something? I don't know.
Yeah, but she made a lot of records, you know, and really successful records as well. And she can actually sing. Got a very distinctive voice.
Oh, right, okay. So anyway, they go down and she said... You know,
do they? Do you want to rephrase that?
Excuse me. Niall Rogers and his friends lived in an apartment only a few blocks away from Studio 54, which was over on the west side, I think, wasn't it? And it was, because I've been there. And so they go down and they knock on, you know, like the stage door, for want of a better word, and, you know, the slat comes open and Niall says, oh, hi, we've come here to see Grace Jones. He said, yeah, so is everybody else. Go around to the front, you know, that's where you go in. No, no, you don't understand. We had a personal invitation for Grace Jones to come and see her. And he said, yeah, okay, buddy, so did everybody else, you know. And the guy said, fuck off, and shut the thing, right?
So, family show, Mike, family show.
Yeah, yes, it is a family show, so I'm sorry about that, but that is a direct, that's a bit of...
It's a quote. It's a verbatim quote.
Thank you, that's the word I was looking for, verbatim. So they go back to Niall Rogers' apartment, and he apparently never gets fed up about anything. He's such an easygoing sort of a guy, you know what I mean? And he said, come on, let's relate this experience. And then starts playing this track where the chorus was, fuck off, fuck off, you know, scream.
I like that. They should re-record it as that.
Yeah, at Studio 54. And of course, that turned into, what did they turn?
Freak Out.
Exactly. That's how he explained how they wrote Freak Out.
That's funny. He wrote probably the most brilliant autobiography of all rock biographies, called The Freak. And if you haven't read it, I thoroughly recommend it. It's hilarious.
Really?
It's a laugh a minute, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. But he's such a nice, normal guy, you know, and he's one of those sort of gems in the rock and roll stratosphere because it hasn't gone to his head.
Yeah. Well, whether it has or not, he kind of... He wears his genius like an overcoat, if you see what I mean. Do you know what I mean? It's just, you know, I don't know how to explain it.
So, he goes out there, he does the show, he's great on stage, and his live act is extraordinary. Yes. But then he comes off stage, and you're quite right, he drops the stardom the way you take an overcoat off.
That's right. Listen, Miss Jones, before we go, I want to talk to you about an amazing story I've read in the last few days. We've talked about magazine editors, and one of them retired and writes a column in a Sunday newspaper is Alexandra Shulman, right? And did she used to be editor of Vogue in this country?
Yes, British Vogue, yeah.
Now, I couldn't believe, she writes a column now, and I couldn't believe she would tell this story, because she thought it was like quite an unusual story. I would never tell this story against myself. She's got obviously a lovely home in, you know, I don't know, North London or South London, I don't know where, but it's a lovely...
And she's got a mangy bum.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a summer's...
Family show.
It's a summer's afternoon, and, you know, she's left the doors open so, you know, the family can move in and out the garden. She goes into one of the rooms because she wants to watch something on the television, and she finds an interloper mangy fox curled up on the couch in front of the TV. So, you know, that's shocking enough, you know, a fox has come into the house, and she said the fox didn't seem that bothered about me discovering him, and they had to literally, you know, pick up a couple of, you know, brushes and get the fox out. So they get the fox out. Then, amazingly...
Get the fox out! that's a great line. You can say that on a family show. For fox's sake, get the fox out!
Yeah, get the fox out. Anyway, amazingly, she then decides to sit in the very seat where the fox has been to watch this TV programme that she'd gone into the TV lounge to watch, okay?
Which is where she went wrong.
Well, over the next few days, she suddenly starts getting all sorts of wheels and red sort of almost bleeding stuff around her posterior. And she is amazed when a few days later it gets worse and it's spread around her body. And eventually, only because her husband told her to, she goes to a top dermatologist to find out she's got some horrendous fucking skin condition from...
Oh, you're swearing again. Come on, come on, keep it down.
But it needed that. From the mangy fox who's left, you know, the mangy fox has left, like, debris of eggs and horrible things on the couch, which have impregnated themselves in Miss Shulman's bottom.
I know, it's disgusting, and it's really worried me. Because this is scabies, by the way, also known as mange.
Right.
It's the same thing. Right. And these are parasitic itch mites that burrow into the skin. It's horrible. It's not usually transferred to humans, but that's where we're at now. It's like with viruses. You know, yeah. we've crossed the line so that these things that afflict animals are now infecting humans much more commonly.
Yeah.
And we have a huge trampoline in our back garden.
Right.
And we quite often come down in the morning to find, no joke, foxes jumping up and down on it.
That's lovely.
My kids, they obviously use the trampoline. They jump, they sunbathe on the trampoline.
Yeah.
And I keep saying to them, now we need to disinfect
this
trampoline because you do not want to get a mangy bum.
Of course. Of course you're going to have to. I just can't believe she did that. I can't believe she didn't say, right, not only am I going to disinfect, I would have thrown the couch into the garden and never sat on it again, frankly. You know what I mean? Never mind disinfecting it and all that.
It might be quite extreme, yeah. That.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, I wouldn't get anywhere near that sort of thing. But anyway, just to close this podcast, I go to a pub near one of the studios I work at in London Bridge, and they have a resident cat. And also, the chairs which accompany their tables are not made of leather or plastic. They're made of material. And when you go in there, if you're first or second in, which we sometimes are, if we finish the show at 10 o'clock and we get in there at 11, you can see the white hairs where and which chair the cat's been sleeping in. You know what I mean? First thing you do, or what I do, is you move that chair, you take it to the other end of the room, and you pull up a chair that's made of leather or plastic or something, which hasn't got the cat on it. How she could have possibly thought she'd get away with occupying the space of a flea-ridden mangy fox, I have no idea. She's, you know.
But not only that, she missed her holiday. They were about to go on holiday to Croatia, and she wasn't able to go. The holiday was cancelled. Yeah. She had to steam clean the house. She had to take all her clothes. Imagine how many clothes the ex-editor of Vogue owns.
Yeah.
She had to take the entire lot to the dry cleaner.
Unbelievable.
So this upturned her life. Mm. But do we know this about Alex Shulman? Mm. Is her bottom better?
Well, I don't know, but I have to say, Miss Jones, I won't be going to bed tonight worrying too much about that one, okay?
Not going out to dinner with her in a hurry either.
No, exactly. That's right. And by the way, if she came round to my house, she wouldn't be sitting on any of my seats.
No, she can bring a black sack.
Bring a black sack and sit on it, yeah. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Been a pleasure to talk to you again. Tell me about the progress of Who Killed John Lennon?
Yeah, it's being received really well. I've been so thrilled over the weekend by so many lovely messages from people. Good. So, you know, onwards and upwards. If you haven't read it, you know where to find it.
Yeah. Well, everybody knows where to find it. Just go along to your local bookshop or look in the Sunday Times and you'll find it herring up to the number one slot. Miss Jones, take care of yourself. Have a good evening. I really, really hope this is the last Planet Porky podcast we ever make in a heat wave, because it's still very, very hot as we record this, and it shouldn't be. It's mid-September. So,
don't worry, Christmas is coming.
Christmas is coming, and can I say, in the next podcast we do, welcome to the Ice Age! I was in LA with Caroline Graham, great friend of yours and mine, the West Coast correspondent of the Mail on Sunday. And that's when the story broke, literally overnight, of Hugh Grant, for some mad reason, must have been the maddest moment of his life, suddenly hearing a tap on the window of his car, and the policeman asked him to open the door, to find a woman down between his legs performing oral sex on him, it is alleged.
Oh, come on. Family show, Mike.
I know.
You can dish it out, but you can't take it.
Yeah, I know. It's a family show and all that. And then...
You know how the police got him, by the way?
Go on.
Because something was going on with the pedals of the car and the lights were going on and off, on and off, rhythmically.
You mean that he was being excited by the woman he'd hired and his feet were tapping up and down on the... Like, the
brake. Allegedly, yeah.
My God. He wasn't particularly famous when they were in New York somewhere and they met Grace Jones, okay? You know, of James Bond.
Grace Jones fame.
Yeah, Grace Jones fame. Yeah, you know, square head, I call her, you know, because she had like a square head, didn't she?
She speaks very highly of
you. I'm sure she does, yeah.
That developed to a little bit of a hanky-panky and dough in the kitchen cupboards.
Yes, I know.
I think his dough rises rather well, from what I've heard.
His dough rises rather well. This is a family show. A few minutes ago, Miss Jones.